And we are back. Thank you so much for joining us for another one of my favorite parts of the show, the interview time, or the interview segment, I should say. And I've been looking forward to this one for a long time. This one's been in the works for probably, two, three months, somewhere in there. And just been really looking forward to him just because a very smart market commentator, but also funny. And reading his stuff has become both informative and cathartic at the same time, at least for me. It makes me feel like I'm not quite as crazy. So without further ado, everybody's favorite green bush, Mr. Le Shrub, or as he's known on Twitter, is Agnostox. Right? So they can follow you on Twitter. It's Agnostoxx, right?
That's it. Yeah. It means actually unknown in Greek. So
Okay.
Unknown XXX. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha.
And now I'm also on shrubstack.com, just where I vent my anger or comments on the market.
It's like I said, it's always amusing. It's always funny and humorous, which is nice. And like I said, there's a catharsis that comes from reading it. And I'm sure it is the same for you as writing. But before
go ahead.
Oh, no. Yeah, tell me.
Investing is a bit of a lonely profession in reality. So, yeah. And I work by myself, and I started writing as a way to, I got into Twitter during COVID. So, and then I started writing this longer form as a way to express myself and, fill these gaps of loneliness in the market, and also just, you know, with all the crazy things happening, it's just started escalating.
Yeah. I said it kind of takes on a life of its own, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Because, the first time I started, I wrote, the first piece I wrote was actually during November, because I thought that bond yields peaked at like 5%. And I actually thought that the market misunderstood Yellen's intentions. So that was the first piece I actually wrote, was about calling a low in bonds and as a consequence as well, a low in the biotech sector. So that's why I wanted to write a longer form piece. And then I started going into the mechanics of how Yellen could actually stimulate the market or keep the yields from spiking from 5%. And I created this fictional character, Tamagotchi Yellen, which basically, for your readers' amusement, basically, I wanted to summarize that central bankers are like, just have a reaction function, that if you figure out the reaction function, you can make a lot of money out of it. So I started by saying, look, Yellen is like a Tamagotchi, those Japanese toys where you kind of feed them and you put them to sleep and then you try to keep them happy. So how do you keep Yellen happy? You keep Yellen happy by keeping the 10-year yield below 5%. So, yep. And it kind of worked. So I kind of think in very simple terms, 5% 10-year yield, Tamagotchi Yellen gets triggered, does stuff to just keep it below. And, lo and behold, she brought it from 5 to 4. Of course, yeah. She got a little greedy in the afterwards and, just pumped it a little bit more, but that's a story we can elaborate afterwards. But, that's how it started.
Yeah. Okay. So before we get into this, and I've got a whole list of stuff here, I've been saving them up, but tell us a little bit about your origin story. First of all, you live in Monaco, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. That to me, like a kid growing up in the suburbs or right outside of Seattle, Washington, you may as well say like Neverland. You know what I mean? Like Monaco. I mean, I'm just thinking yachts. I'm thinking Grand Prix. I'm thinking sunshine and pretty people. How did you end up there? Where are you from? What's your origin story? How'd you get into the business? And how do you go about ending up in Monaco? It just sounds so much better than Tacoma, Washington. So I'm a little jealous.
Well, I actually reached Monaco further than from a place further than Seattle. I started in Cyprus. Actually, no, Cyprus is closer to Monaco than Seattle. So,
yeah, but
I grew up in Cyprus, so. From a very different background, not knowing much about the markets. And, I was a geek at school. I was studying a lot, and I ended up reading a few books, like One Up on Wall Street from Peter Lynch was actually the first investment book I read. And I got a little bit hooked because it started with the 2000 bubble, when, you know, things were really, really crazy. And the story that I tell people, which was, to me, is the most important story one can get out of the stock market. At the time, my parents each had their own stock portfolio, which was because we actually had capital controls where I grew up. The stock portfolio was only in Cyprus, so it was only Cypriot companies. And back then, it was a very, while you guys had your own bubble, we had our own bubble for no reason whatsoever, whereby even if you had, like, I remember the corner shop, the 9-11 of my neighborhood, IPO'd and reached a 1 million pound valuation. So this was a corner shop. And 1 million pound in 2000 in Cyprus was like, I don't know, man, that was like serious money. So people got crazy and they started like doing crazy stuff. And anyway, because my parents worked in you know, public companies, they both had a listed stock portfolio. And my mother at some point, you know, she sold hers in 2000. She's like, you know what? I'm going to sell this. I'm going to buy a, I'm going to buy ourselves a beach house so we enjoy our summers. So she sold all her stock. And my dad was like, just like, nah, you know what? I'm a long-term investor because like my, like his father as well was the same thing. They worked in this company for a very long time and they're like long-term investors. So they just kept all their stock. Well, their stock went down 90%. And guess where I spend all my summers 20 years later? I spend them in my mother's beach house.
Hey,
so let me just finish on that point. So my mother always tells that one thing. You know, you can, because she knows the job I'm doing. And she's like, yeah, fine. You know, you trade in paper. Great. Remember that. But remember one thing. It's called real estate for a reason, because it's real. That's right. Why I always tell people, you know, you got to have some real assets, real estate, real assets, commodities, all that, because that's what stays in the end. We can have a lot of fun right now, but 10 years down the line, that's what you're going to remember. Sorry.
Yeah, no.
Sorry for interrupting you.
No, it's funny you say that. I'm in the process of doing that right now, actually. I'm taking, was blessed to have an opportunity to bring on a partner and sell a piece of a non-controlling interest in our firm. And I'm putting those proceeds and investing in real estate for very much the exact same reasons that we talked about. Or that you're talking about. So now you work at a family office? Are you managing your own money? Do you manage outside money? Is it correct to say that you're at a family office or you run a family office? Kind of give us what you're up to now.
So, you know, just a brief one. So I used to work in hedge funds. I spent like from 2006 to 2021 working in hedge funds. And now I just run a family office, so one portfolio, and then I run my own portfolio as well.
Okay.
So I don't have any other external investors. So it's just one friend's family office and just my own. So you know, that gives me a lot of flexibility. You know, working in hedge funds was, I always enjoyed it. I mean, I pretty much still do the same thing, you know, having the flexibility of an open mandate makes a big difference nowadays.
Yeah.
And it showed in 2021, 22, it was made a big, big difference in performance.
Yeah, no, to be unconstrained in this environment is a huge deal. I can't imagine having to manage a portfolio under a strict mandate right now. And really almost wouldn't even matter what the mandate was in this market.
Exactly, yeah.
You know what I mean? You need that latitude and that flexibility because it's so crazy.
Exactly.
Okay, so now moving into a little bit, I oftentimes when I'm sitting down preparing for an interview like this, it sort of lays itself out. You were a little bit different though, just because I had so many different places that I thought, okay, we could start here, we could start here, we could start here. Why don't we just kind of start from the top down and just when you're looking at this, and then I want to get into some of your Substack articles, which people really need to. People are either probably like, Zach, you always promote the people stuff. And I go, yeah, I do always promote it because I have guys on whose stuff I like to read. Right. So, you know, folks really need, in my opinion, need to subscribe to your Substack and read it just because, like I said, it's, you're very good at putting things in a light, humorous way, but also delivering very dense information and big concepts. And it's a very difficult thing to do. So I know you spend a lot of time synthesizing and organizing those thoughts, right? When you're looking at this market today, and this is a very broad question, we'll kind of drill down as we get into it, but what do you see? What are you thinking? What do you think the drivers of this are? Do you think, you know, it's probably a confluence of things, but just kind of give us your 30,000 foot view of how you're looking at things right now.
Yeah. It's, you know, like you said, I actually try to make things, you know, one of my principles is KISS, you know, keep it simple, shrub. So I try to make things because, you know, I've been doing this for nearly 20 years. And one reason I enjoy interacting with retail investors and just writing these things is if I can make it simple to them, it means I understood it. So that's why I just, you know, this persona of the shrub is pretty cool, actually, because it helps me. You know, it's like, guys, it's a shrub explaining to you a concept. You have to figure it out. Seriously, it's not like George Soros.
Right.
So let's just think about this market now. So I've been trying to figure out the comparisons between 2021 and 2024. And there's some very big differences, which are quite scary. The one thing is, 2021, we had zero rates, and the Fed balance sheet was increasing by $120 billion a month. Right now, we're at 5% rates, and the Fed balance sheet is decreasing by $90 billion a month. So why on earth are we at all-time highs? And I think the reason is, one, AI is actually a very big driver that came in from 2023. It's a very big stimulus for money to come in. That's why the market is narrow, right? So the breadth isn't that great. Like, because one big difference between 21 and 24, in 21, seriously, because I have no inhibitions. 21, I was loaded up with SPACs.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I come from an arbitrage background. So the SPACs, you know how it works. You buy, you know, above 10, you know, if you buy below 10, around 10, your downside was 10. So I was playing like, you know, SPACs and, you know, all these deals getting announced, and, you know, it was a pretty profitable thing. But you literally could have made money in everything in 21.
Yeah.
In 2024, I mean, the breadth isn't that great. You know, I turned quite bullish commodities two days ago, but that's a different story. They only started working today because the dollar just took like a little bit of a beating. But, you know, besides that, it wasn't that of a good of a market. So AI is definitely one very strong thing that's differentiating. The second thing is, I think there's been a lot of games played with the person I call the Tamagotchi Yellen in terms of doing covert liquidity injections in the market. And I think that made a very, very big difference. And that's why I try to write about this in a very, very simple way. But in reality, Yellen hijacked the monetary policy. So it's the first time that we have the Treasury controlling fiscal and monetary in a very covert way. And how did she do that? Well, you know, the RRP got drained. Basically, if the Fed is competing with the RRP, by draining RP, she's basically controlling the rate at when the QT is going to end. Let's put it this way.
Yeah. Yep.
So that liquidity injection has stimulated the market. The third thing is people underestimate what I say, that the market is run by monkeys, and, you know, I'm part of it.
Yeah.
So we get excited about things and we just chase. So they get excited about AI and they just chase AI, or they get excited about the market going up. They chase the market. I mean, it doesn't matter if the market is, it doesn't matter if rates are 3 or 5.
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically it's what Keynes would call the animal spirits, right? So yep. The animal spirits are a very big driver of this.
which you'd expect when you see the level of retail involvement and all that kind of stuff. I the one thing that I did want to talk to you about that, and I'm glad you brought up Tamagotchi Yellen. The first time I saw that, I totally understood and got your analogy, and I it was a spit your coffee moment out. You know, I was laughing because I went, it's just perfect. Tamagotchi Yellen, I love it. One of the things that now I don't know where you're at on this. I've heard you talk about it, and it sounds like we're on pretty similar read. But one of the things that I've noticed, including if you look at when this market took off last year, and what it looked like, right? I think it's very notable that while interest rates continued higher next year, the turning point, or last year, the turning point for the market was when we were staring down a bank run, right? And the SVB facility got launched, and wham, there we go again, right? I think it's really interesting because I think once again the central banks have done the way I've equated it to, or what I've equated it to, is I said I feel like they're trying to brush their teeth while eating Oreos. Right. So they're undoing what they're doing as quick as they raise the rates and then they flood liquidity. I've come to believe that I think the biggest impact that rates have on the system is soaking up liquidity, right? Taking it out. And so if you're jacking rates, but you're pumping liquidity in the backside, it's almost like you're undoing your own rate cuts, right? And then the other thing to me, just from a observation of the Federal Reserve and central banks and It amazes me that they don't see this or at least acknowledge it, because for 15 years they were using liquidity to try to generate inflation, right? And now all of a sudden they act like liquidity doesn't matter and they can just raise rates. And then, like you said, you know what Yellen's issuing, refusing to loan anything out, any duration, right? So I'm at this weird point where I'm not sure whether I believe what they say. Right, like because I'm sitting there going, wait a second, you believed for 15 years that liquidity injections could drive inflation up, and now you don't believe that liquidity injections are going to spur inflation? How do you square that?
Well, I think that's what gold is telling you, and you know that's why the end game is with a currency debasement. I think it's as simple as that. And this thing about let me tell you one thing. So QT, for example, is on autopilot. So when Yellen was the Fed chair, she said, oh, it's going to be like watching paint dry,
yeah.
Right? So she's basically letting QT on autopilot, but she has the flexibility. So she did that when she was Fed chair, right? So the QT is on autopilot. But on her side, now that she's in Treasury, what can she do? She can tweak how many bills versus bonds are issued. And usually it's 20 bills, 80 bonds. And that adds liquidity. The more bills you have, the more liquidity you add. On her last one, she added like 60% bills, 58% bills. That's why I said, you know, she's like a Evita Perón. She should be like, don't cry for me, Argentina. So that's why it's a bit of a made-up game. And, you know, the market at some point is figuring it out. I mean, and you can argue that, look, why are equities going up with bonds not doing much? You could argue it's because equities are a play against debasement in some way. And whenever people say that, by the way, it doesn't end well, huh?
Yeah.
And that's why I track gold as well. I'm not a big fan of gold. I prefer every other commodity, but gold is a good indicator whether the market believes in the debasement and now they're believing it again. I mean, let's not even get to Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin is telling you that the Gen Xers, they really believe in debasement because they're just driving it to the roof.
Yeah, yeah. Where do you when I look at this market, you know, I step back and here in the U.S. we're running deficits that are nearly 7% of GDP, right? I haven't seen those levels since World War II, and we're doing that with full employment, right? Like just madness.
It's crazy, crazy.
It is. But here's the thing. I am shocked. I'm shocked that we haven't had a recession yet, but I'm not when I look at the fiscal side of it, right? I think the analogy I've been using is I think that there is a hole in the bathtub, but you got a higher flow faucet just cranking full tilt, right? So the level of that. And you know, I don't know that they have a choice now. Are we at the point, do you think, where this doesn't get shut off? Meaning they're not – are we at a point where this is just business as usual? You know, and then if it is on the one of the things we've been wrestling with here too, is on any metric you look at, valuations are insanely elevated, right? And the one thing people will cite, well, is it's not as bad as PE ratio, and I'm like, yeah, but man, when you factor in stock based comp, all these other things, right? The record spread between adjusted earnings being reported and earnings that are being paid taxes on, right? Like you look at all these things, you're like, okay, that's one out of 10 valuation metrics. And there's a lot of caveats. All other nine are at record highs. But then a part of me sits there and goes, I think equities in general probably carry less downside risk than they used to because of the actions of central banks. So I think we're in a bubble. I think it's a mess. I think it's absurd. I agree with everything you write. The question I have is, I don't really know that there's – I don't think that they can stop. I kind of feel like they've got a tiger by the tail.
I think that's the problem. That's why the Tamagotchi's job is the most crucial job right now, because what – you know, what could – she painted herself in a corner whereby with a 6-7% deficit, I mean – even if you slow down to 3, you're going to have a recession now. So what else can you do? So,
I mean,
and that's why the one thing though I will say is I'm a believer in that there's a re-election cycle, not an election cycle. It's a re-election cycle. So the fact that they went so hard into the election to do everything they can for Trump not to get elected, I think maybe come Jan 25 and you could have like a little bit of a wake up call. How does that happen? Let me tell you a scenario that this happens. Do you remember Liz Truss in the UK?
What's that?
Liz Truss.
Yep.
Liz Truss was the prime minister of the UK that lasted less than a lettuce. So they actually put a lettuce and they said that this lettuce is going to last longer than Liz Truss. And the lettuce actually lasted longer. She only lasted a few weeks. Why? Because, you know, everyone knows the UK is an emerging market, right? So, I mean, it's a G7 country, but it's really an emerging market.
Right.
So she came up with an aggressive budget deficit, and it was so aggressive that the bond sold off and the market lost confidence. So I think the Liz Truss moment was a prelude of what could happen one day in the US, but it could happen. We saw a glimpse of that when yield spiked at 5%, but they immediately patched it with the bills issuance. And then I think they're going to patch it next time. They're going to patch it with a QT runoff slowing down, because the QT is impacting a lot. So they have a few levers to put, but when you're at 120% debt to GDP and you're spending so much and your fiscal deficit is 6-7, at some point it's going to hit. Now, I think the market is actually pricing a little bit to that, because when that happens, it's actually debasing for the currency in some way. Like there's only two ways, right? Either the currency is going to take a hit, in which case S&P is going to go to 10,000, which is what the S&P is kind of like pricing as a small probability here. Or suddenly someone sensible will come to the treasury and the next Tamagotchi is going to be a fiscally prudent individual, which, to be honest, I'm ascribing like a less than 10% chance between the two candidates that you have. So I don't see it. So that's why it's a very, very big, that's why risk assets are where they are. I mean, there is something like that priced in the market right now.
Yeah. No, well, and it's something, I mean, I said repeatedly last year, and I meant it in real time, throughout the year, I said, look, if we don't have a recession by the first quarter of 2024, it's going to change the way that we manage money. And we have done that now. So we are working on getting a new approval. And basically we're big time risk managers, you know, active managers ourselves. And the way we're dealing with this environment, man, is having a core group of holdings that we feel very good about, reasonable valuation, solid balance sheets, all that kind of stuff, prefer, you know, with good solid income by way of dividends if we can get it and things like that. And then using options to tail the hedges to hedge the tails on both sides. And we basically came to that place out of necessity, just going, look, this does look like a market to me for all the wrong reasons that could go on a double, you know, some crazy 99 style run. And you mentioned it, you got all the things in place, right? You got the obscene deficits and fiscal situation. You've got what both our mutual friend Dimitri Kafinas calls, financial nihilism, right? You know, dog with a hat, and I pronounce, have you heard this one? It WIF, dog with a hat.
About retardio? There's a coin called retardio. I mean, that's my favorite one. It's like, seriously. And I misspell it. So I misspelled it as retardo. And I have a whole army of crypto bots on Twitter saying, it's not retardo, it's retardio. Believe in retardio. And I was like, guys, I mean, it's so retarded. I might as well just, it's funnier if I spell it the wrong way.
I thought it was retardo. I missed the I. I think I just got caught up in that first syllable. We look at all this madness going on. What are the things that you like in this environment? And then I also want to get your thoughts on Bitcoin, because it sounds to me like you have a similar take on it that I do, which is, I think the vast majority of this crypto stuff is nonsense. Yet at the same time, I feel like it's a beautiful catch basin for excess liquidity, right? Absolutely. So I feel torn. It's like a schism, right? Well, what is your take on that?
I think with crypto, so I wrote a piece called Save the Ponzi's, Save the Plebs.
I remember.
And I wrote that in November, and the premise was very simple. It was Yellen going, you remember the show Heroes? There was a guy coming from the future, and he was telling the other superheroes, save the cheerleader, save the world. So similarly, I was thinking, you know what? Yellen is going to the treasury and is telling them, in order to save the plebs, so us, and keep their jobs, because we need to keep their jobs so that they can vote for our guy in November 24, to save the plebs' jobs, you have to pump liquidity. So you have to save the Ponzi's in order to save the jobs. So my premise was, save the Ponzi's, save the plebs. So I wrote that piece and I was like, you know what, guys, this is like bullish for risk. So unfortunately, you know, don't be short Ponzi's, because, well, she wants you to be long the Ponzi's, she as in Yellen. Yeah. So I had a very smart friend that pinged me and said, you know what, I read your piece and it got me really, really bullish crypto, because Ponzi, I mean, crypto is the ultimate Ponzi. So you got to go along the ultimate Ponzi. And this was like in November or something, December. And since then, I mean, I listened to him. I was like, you know what? You're absolutely right. So he went long Bitcoin, Ethereum, and he went long Pepe coin or something. And Pepe did like 30X. So I was like, you know what? I'm just glad that my readers are smarter than me. Like, I get it in their mind. And I have this positive feedback as well. But, you know, I'm just glad that I have like smart readers that benefit out of seeing the second derivative trades.
You know, there's something to that. And in no way am I going to correlate myself or compare myself to Druckenmiller, but it does remind me of how he used to talk about how frustrated he'd get that no matter how good he did, Soros would edge him out, right? I've noticed that, meaning I have had several listeners who have taken my plays or my ideas and just gone at them way harder than I did and have blown it out. one of my clients called me, this was 2022. And it was in the summer of 2022. And I go, how's your account doing that you're trading? And he goes, Zach, I'm up 50% on the year. And I go, how? And he goes, short tech, long energy, just like you said. And I go, how much your portfolio did do it? And he goes, I took 50% and went short tech and went 50% and went long energy. And I went, wow, okay, I didn't tell you to do that. But he blew. What do you think that dynamic is? Why is it that that seems to happen where you come up with the idea and you're on the right trade? I had it expressed in our portfolios in 2022. What is that though? Why does it seem like other guys get more mileage out of it than the guy that comes up with it?
Well, I mean, the mandate helps. So for example, you wouldn't be able to do that for 100% of your client's money.
No. Yeah.
But he can do it on his own. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, it depends what you feel comfortable with. Like, I actually don't feel comfortable owning crypto, but my friend does. So he has the mental capacity to size it up properly. So I would be able to put like 1% of my portfolio in crypto, but he was willing to go in like, you know, all in. So that's a different type of mindset. And also knowing the asset class, like in 22, for example, I was actually very long energy, short tech, but I know the energy space. I know the commodity space. 23, 24, it was an AI driven market. And to be honest, I'm like although I studied engineering, I'm like technologically literate. So I have to sit down and just study. Like, I'm only getting to grips with, you know, Nvidia, what Nvidia does, and Marvell and all these guys. And that's why, you know, I wrote that piece, Nvidia from a boomer's perspective. You know, I reviewed Nvidia's result from a boomer's perspective that doesn't know anything about tech. And, you know, that's why I try to add like a different perspective to something obvious. So, you know, when you asked about, you know, what I like, you know, you look at Nvidia's results and, you know, you have to get excited about energy because, you know, one Nvidia GPU consumes as much as one US household in energy almost. So I estimated that.
Just one? That's how big? I knew the number was big.
Yeah, let me tell you the number. So basically, one household consumes 29 kilowatt hours a day. One Nvidia H100 consumes, at a 60% utilization, 10 kilowatt hours a day. So basically, it consumes as much as one person. So one household is 29, one GPU is 10. So one person would be like 10. So yeah, so I've estimated that NVIDIA is going to sell 2 million H100s in 2024. And that would add 690,000 US households to the grid. So the average household formation in 23 was 1.67 million households.
But that means just NVIDIA is adding. But there's another one, right? There's another power consumption here on the other side of it because the cooling costs of those server farms that have these things, that's got to be outrageous as well.
Yeah, put it all together. Yeah, put it all together. It's just adding up. So basically, just the NVIDIA GPUs are adding increase of power demand by 40% more than the baseline level of growth.
Jeez.
So there's a lot of side trades that you can think around these things.
Which brings it, and you brought up NVIDIA, and obviously reading your piece, that was definitely one of the things I wanted to hit on. But it's also one of the things that cracks me up in this market because we've jokingly said over and over internally, and I think you know my head of research, Chase Taylor or Pinecone Macro.
Yeah, he's amazing.
He's a great guy. But something that he and I have talked a lot about is that it's not just that they're chasing, that it's like this dumbest market of all time, right? Like a good play for us this year has been in the last 12 months has been Taiwan Semiconductor. And the thesis on it was pretty simple. First of all, I think it had a lot of geopolitical risk based on stuff the company was saying. I thought the geopolitical risk was overstated. I think they've made a lot of – I think they've done a lot of things to hedge that risk, right? Including the CEO talking about moving a lot of their intellectual property, right? Their minds, their best minds off site. But – You look at them chasing NVIDIA, and then you look at something like Taiwan Semiconductor trading at 26, 27 times earnings, right? And NVIDIA can't do what they do without them, right? And everybody's like, yeah, but you know, it only makes up 10% of Taiwan Semiconductor's business. And I go, yeah, but you guys are forecasting a 10x on NVIDIA, right? So how does that not translate? It seems like the dumbest market. And NVIDIA to me seems full stop. So if you wouldn't mind, and I don't want you to have to go line by line through it, But I would like our listeners to hear the outline of your piece on NVIDIA, looking at it through a boomer's perspective, and then, of course, add your shrub color onto it. But yeah, walk us through that. Walk us through that little exercise that you did with NVIDIA.
Yeah, sure. So I'm going to just do the obvious. Let's start with a simple one. So there's two stages in training an AI algorithm. So the first stage is the training stage. The second stage is the inference stage. So in simple terms, first you train the AI algorithm, and then the algorithm uses the training to make inferences from data. So NVIDIA is the best, if not the only game in town, because they have the best chip for the training. So if you want to train your LLM, your ChatGPT, you're going to need your NVIDIA chips. But once you go to the inference stage, once you trained it, then it opens up space for competition. So inference is about speed and cost. You're not going to use your $30,000, $40,000 NVIDIA chip to do your training. Now, UBS had originally estimated that 90% of chip demand would stem from training, and that inference would only be 20% by 2025. So one number that everyone missed, obviously, from NVIDIA's results, because no one reads results nowadays anyway, was that 40% of their data center revenue was actually from inference. Now, that 40% is very important because that means that AI is moving towards inference already. And what that means is, in very simple terms, think about it this way. Microsoft and all these guys, they spent close to $20 billion a quarter to NVIDIA, $18.4 billion. So these guys, what the market is not realizing is that these guys, they don't want to spend $18 billion a quarter to NVIDIA, but they have to because they're training their models. They don't know what their end product looks like. To build your inference chips, so the custom silicon part, you want to know your product. So what I think, you know, the simple boomer's perspective from NVIDIA, as someone who's worked in commodities for a long time, is you have this amazing CapEx up front where they benefit from. So it's like the iron ore that built China kind of thing. But once you build it, you don't really need to stick with that. You can move to something else down the line. You need the copper or you need the other stuff to build you build the house, now you need to build the wiring, for example. So, right. So that opens up competition from other producers. So what I think is going to happen in 2-3 years down the line, if not sooner, you're actually going to see competition to NVIDIA. Because right now everyone says, oh, NVIDIA, it's the only game in town. It's like, no, it's not. The whole point is, well, you know, TSM is a classic example where you see them benefiting from Microsoft, the hyperscalers building their own chips. So the other thing, though, is that I picked up, which I actually picked it up from a tweet from Jim Chanos, is this, that there is an accounting incentive for this whole data center build out to take place. So NVIDIA gets $18 billion of data center revenue from the hyperscalers, so the Microsofts of this side. But the hyperscalers, they don't book $18 billion as an expense on their income statement. They book it as CapEx on their cash flow statement. Then they put it on their balance sheet, and they depreciate it over 4 to 7 years. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. It's fine. But the thing is, because the hyperscalers are sitting on a ton of cash, and they can't do any acquisitions, they're incentivized to spend billions upfront so they can, you know, so they can get their data centers, and they're only going to depreciate that over 5 years. So they don't take the hit. They spread over 5 years. But meanwhile, NVIDIA takes revenue day one. So people, it's mind-numbing, because people are, when they extrapolate this, they should be extrapolating what Microsoft and these guys are going to spend as CapEx over the next 5 years. And they're assuming that Microsoft is just going to spend everything to NVIDIA and just going to keep growing and just spend all its profits to NVIDIA, where actually the thing is, it could happen for another 1 or 2 years, sure. But actually then Microsoft is going to be spending less to NVIDIA. And also, it's kind of like it's a CapEx cycle in some way. But let me tell you one other thing. That's because there's a lot of comparison with Cisco of 2000 and NVIDIA of 2024. So I plotted Cisco. Cisco had a 700% rally from 98 to 2000. And then it dropped 80%. The important thing is that the company was growing really fast. So I plotted, I focused on the growth rate. So Cisco was growing 40 to 60% on their top line.
Jeez.
And at the beginning of 21, its growth rate was 66%. By the end of 21, its growth rate was negative 32%. So now you look at NVIDIA. Their latest revenue growth print was 265%. Which is insane. I mean, it's accelerated like crazy. And the stock price is also up 700%. So I'm tracking the revenue growth to see when it tails off before I call a top. But we have a precedent here. And I know that 2021 is a long time for this market. Like, people forget what happened in 21. But in 21, we had this crypto boom bust of NVIDIA. And you remember NVIDIA was, again, the golden child. Mm-hmm. So NVIDIA was up 600% during the crypto boom. It had 100% growth rates. Once the growth rate slowed down to 50%, the stock was down 60%.
Okay, what was I lost you. My point is, we went blank.
Sorry. My point is, the growth is very high as it is, but you have to be tracking the growth rate to fall, and then you'll be able, not the growth rate. You need to see the rate of growth coming down, not growth itself. So it's like a second derivative.
Right.
And once that happens, then you can call a top. Because, you know, from my earlier comment is, if you think that there is an incentive of the hyperscaler to stop spending, giving their money to NVIDIA, and if you think that NVIDIA is a CapEx play, you know, it means to me there will be a point where NVIDIA is going to have a sharp fall. My point is this, basically, just to clarify it again. If Cisco was down 60% by the growth slowing down, and we also have the NVIDIA crypto cycle precedent that with just the growth from 100 to 50, the stock was down 60%, I bet you in the next 12 months, we're going to have something similar with NVIDIA.
Yeah.
But I'm not there to call it yet, because I wrote a piece a couple of days ago, Beware the Ides of March 18th, where I laid out a timeline. I don't know if you're familiar with the Shrub's law of large numbers.
Yes.
So Shrub's law of large numbers is that if you have a big number, it's an aspirational big number, the market is going to just gravitate to that number. So for example, S&P 5000, SMCI 1000, Bitcoin 69,000. You know, we levitated towards those numbers. And now you have NVIDIA 1000, we're like 10% away. And I'm just so confident. I am quite confident that it's in everyone's incentive to drive it there. And there's a path to get it there. The reason why it's the Ides of March 18th is because NVIDIA has their AI day in March 18th, where they're going to talk about the best AI in the world. And it's going to be able to make you the best coffee in the world or something. So the excitement into it is going to drive it there. And also on the same day, which is, again, is I think is an important milestone, SMCI, so that's like the tier two NVIDIA play of the Russell, is going to enter the S&P 500. So you have two pretty big milestones in September, in March 18th, which I'm actually really curious to see how the market runs up to that event, because I'm I'm itching to buy puts, and I want to just see how it is into March 15th before I press the button. Because, you know, as you know, I track this index. You know, I have my proprietary index of max stupid. So I'm trying to see how stupid the market gets. And to me, that could be the climax that gets me there. You know, when people get their NVIDIA 1000 hats,
yes,
and SMCI is up like 30% on the index inclusion, that's when I'm going to be like, you know what? Okay, there we
yeah,
are.
Yeah, we've reached max stupid level, right?
Okay. Max stupid.
Okay, so when we – what else – because I'm right with you on the commodity side of it, meaning everything that I hear talked about, literally everywhere I turn – all I hear is, you know, whether it's the Inflation Reduction Act, which I still chuckle over that, you know, we're going to spend money to bring inflation down. Only in DC, only in DC, right? You know, when I look at, I just keep hearing demand and incessant demand for commodities, right? Whether we're talking uranium, whether we're talking oil. Here's another one, right? You're seeing this push against nat gas. Good luck. Good flipping luck. When you start looking at the GPUs you're talking about plugging into the grid, you throw that on top of the electric vehicles that are being plugged into the grid. Good luck, right? It was funny. I was actually talking to a friend of mine that was the lead guy at a local utility, right? A state run utility. And he's running for the board now of the utility company out where I live. And he and I were talking about it over the weekend, and I'm actually going to interview him on the show because he said, look, this is beyond politics, right? This guy has dedicated his career to this. And he said, one of the big things I'm going to push is to restart up nat gas plants. And he goes, Zach, he goes, there's no way to bridge the gap. He goes, so unless these people want to see sky high energy prices, we've only got one answer. And it's nat gas. And he goes, they can ignore it all they want, but it is what it is. Is that what's driving – well, obviously that's a big component of what's driving your interest in commodities. But where do you see the best opportunities? Are you looking at uranium? Is it nat gas? What's got your attention?
Well, can I cannot not mention tin because I'm a very big tin fan. Because if you put together, you know, the demand for tin is like 50% is semiconductors. So the demand side is growing and the supply side is a disaster. So like Indonesia is, 20% of the market, and they had a lot of scandals and their exports dropped to zero the last few months. So you have a situation where demand is strong, but could get much stronger from the semiconductor AI play. And then the supply side is there's no new supply. And the problem is that there's only two listed companies. There's one in Canada, Alphamin, which is the mine is in the DRC, so people don't want to own it for geopolitical risk. And there's one in Australia called Metals X. So I'm very, very bullish tin, although you can't size that trade up. And the other one I'm still long, I listened to it on your show the first time, was Peabody.
Oh yeah.
I think you mentioned it like 2022.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With your head of research. Yeah. So you were going Peabody. I'm actually very bullish Peabody right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you know, back when you guys were talking about it, since then they delevered their balance sheet. They're sitting on $1 billion of cash, net cash. Elliott has been selling down their stake because it's not ESG. So, you know, God forbid you have a non-ESG stock in your portfolio. And, you know, the stock is like a 30% free cash flow yield. So, you know, I'm bullish Peabody, which is like a nat gas play in
right,
some way.
Right.
Bullish tin. Yeah. I have to be bullish oil. Inevitably, I mean, oil is going to just be 70-90 range maybe for another year, but you know, at some point the supply side is not responding outside of the Middle East. And also, you know, the other one that I actually bought a couple of days ago was platinum group metals. So I bought this company called Anglo American, which is a pretty bizarre setup because everyone's getting excited about lithium, but actually demand for electric vehicles has gone down and demand for petrol vehicles is picking up and hybrids. So if you want, so actually demand for platinum group metals is going to go up.
Yeah.
And the supply is a disaster because again, there's four companies in South Africa and no one's making money. This one could take place a while. It could take a bit of time to play out, but they're beaten up and they kind of feel like, kind of feels like coal a few years ago in some way. So that's my interesting commodity plays of the time.
Kind of switching now, looking at a more broader perspective, one of the things that we've been talking about here and we've been focused on, well, not focused. I mean, there's nothing we can really do about it, but conceptualizing and trying to, one of the things that I've found through my career is trying to have a feel or an understanding of what is currently going on in markets is very important. And whenever I feel like I don't understand, now, whether I agree with it or not is one thing, but when I feel like I don't understand, one of the things I've learned to do is just pull back, right? Until I feel like I've got my hands on at least what's driving it, what the market's responding to. And in an effort to keep our fingers on the pulse of that, one of the things that we're toying with the idea, and we alluded to it earlier in our discussion, was have we crossed over the Rubicon? Meaning, I think you can make a case that there is no return to quote unquote normal from here. The imbalances are too large, right? And if you think about what precipitated central bank involvement to the level that we're currently at, they wouldn't take it this far and then finally realize or stare down the realization of all their greatest fears and that simply be a byproduct of them stepping aside, right? Meaning, you know, they had to get us out of this malaise. They had to nullify the risks, all that kind of stuff to get us a recovery. Now I think you have a situation where all of the things that they feared taking place would take place simply from them stepping aside, right? And so almost like the market has baked them in as being a constant liquidity source. And then when you look at the U.S. retirement setup, how everybody is reliant, it's not like it was in the 60s, right, where you're relying on pensions. You're relying on the S&P 500, right? And when you look at the size of the baby boomer generation, their income needs, it's really – I think when you look at the whole situation, it's really hard to see the U.S. economy growing without the S&P 500 going up.
Oh, yeah. The market is the economy.
Right.
Yeah.
And my question is do you think that they've realized that? I mean, they're never going to admit that, right? Like, you know, but have they realized it? And if we pass that point of no return, which is
– I think they know it. That's why they're in – yeah. That's why they're – you know, that's why this market is a Yellen market. You know, we've lived through that market before where, you know, every little dip is bought aggressively. So let me give you an example why I think they realize it. Do you remember how we started the year with a small dip? So you remember the Tamagotchi I said has a reaction function, 5% 10-year. So we were 2% from the all-time high in January, and the 10-year was at 4.2%. So we only had a 2% dip. And what did they do? They started talking about the QT, unwinding QT or, you know, reducing QT. So I saw that. And I wrote a piece called The Cute QT Tease. Because, you know, I have to keep it funny for my readers. But also, when I wrote that piece, I realized what you just said, that why is she intervening? Why is she doing this on a 2% dip from the all-time highs? And the reason is that they just don't want to have any dips. They want to keep this going. It's a re-election cycle. they at least want to keep it into the election because people's wealth is depending on the S&P and on Nvidia right now.
Yeah.
Nancy Pelosi knows it. So you know, they want to keep this going. And that's why the dips are bought, and that's why the liquid is injected, and that's why they're pulling all these things. Like, I really think that Yellen is like one of the greatest financial engineers of our generation. I really think so. And, you know, credit to her, you know, well done. But to your point about sometimes you have to step back, you know, I have to admit that at some point I was like, a few times, I have to step back and just say, what the hell is going on? And that's why I like to visualize these stupid things like a Tamagotchi and you know, like make little stories around them, because it kind of helps me, because things are so stupid. Right. You almost need a stupid persona like a shrub to figure them out sometimes. And that's what I'm here to do.
No, and it is. And I don't think the average person realizes how ludicrous this all is. And, you know, and they keep running and, you know, they've been trained to, especially that's one of the unique things about this environment too, that really scares me is because, and I haven't really heard anybody talk about this, but when we talk about the propensity or the ability for this market to basically explode to the upside, to crash up, you know, we compare it to 99, but what's interesting and going into 99, you didn't have a period in the last 3 years that saw the market go up 70% in the space of like 14 months, right? So this time you've actually had a warm up for it, right? And you've trained investors, yeah, right? That, hey, get you know, the setup, you've conditioned them. There's a Pavlovian response where when you go back to 99, it was sort of a one-off, right? That's what I find so troubling about this, because I'm not going to lie to you. Like we were alluding to earlier, I see the potential for the NASDAQ to double in the next 16 months.
Nothing would surprise me.
No, I know. So how are you playing that? Do you have any exposure to the NASDAQ? How is the shrub navigating this? You've got your commodities. I get that. Are you playing any of this? Are you doing any of the kind of stuff that we're talking about, which is using small amounts of this stuff, mostly via calls to hedge the tails? Or are you just sitting there going, okay.
Yeah. So I'm long my commodity plays. That's the one thing. I do have mid-cap value names. So, for example, I own a Prism stock, you know, Geo Services.
We know it. I've held it at one time. Yeah.
Yeah. So I own cheap stuff like that. That's my core portfolio. But I also do own stuff like, you know, I own Marvell.
So do we.
yeah, there you go. So, but I do it with calls. So I roll my calls up because I'm not that educated in the space. So I do own calls in Marvell. I do have a cheeky call in Nvidia because I actually think that we're going to get the $1,000 hat. So once we get the, so I want to see the $1,000 hat first, yep. But that's like a, you know, punt money kind of thing. But I do actually have some other fundamental, you know, deeper value names in the space. Like, you know, I have a semiconductor name in custom silicon, you know, like something a little bit more elaborate. And, you know, I have to tell you, like, the smart plays around AI, they wouldn't have made as much as if I just went long Nvidia.
Yeah, right.
So that's the annoying thing, right? If there's one thing to learn, is just buy the biggest bloody play and just stick to it. Because, you know, I spent a lot of time figuring out custom silicon, and I bought, you know, this one play in the UK, and I bought Marvell. But no, I'd be better off just buying Nvidia.
Yeah. Well, the only problem, though, and I know that this is almost assuredly what stayed your hand on that, though. And something that we've been trying to explain to our listeners is, guys, when you get something that is that stretched fundamentally, that's where one bad headline, you wake up to a 40% drop. You know what I mean?
Big time.
And you can't hedge that, right? It'll jump your stops. No. You know, there's just no way to play it. And yet at the same time, like I can't remember who I was reading, but he said something, it might've been Chainos actually. Speaking of which, I'm actually working on getting connected with him. I wanted to have try to set up an interview with him that I just want to discuss his career. Just go right for, you know, yeah, the 90s, Enron, GFC, and just kind of, you know, he's shutting it down or he shut it down already. And just kind of, he's been a guy that I've watched for years and just admired the research and the tenacity and his ability to stand up and tell the emperor that he's naked. You know,
I love him. I have a chain of story if you want it. Do you want a chain of story?
Yeah, you got to give it to me.
Okay. So I was working, 2008-09, I was working for one of the hedge funds that did the big short.
Yep.
Right. And so, you know, we had a good 08, good 09.
I bet.
So 09, I remember I saw Chainos on TV and he was talking about, you know, how terrible China is and about the end of the world. Maybe actually it was 08. So it was like, you know, this is like, he was talking so negatively. It was like you wanted to just chew your hand off almost. And then at night, I went clubbing with some friends. And next to me was Chainos. And he was like the happiest guy. So I remember just seeing like Chainos on TV being like so, you know, menacing and like sounding out omens. And then at night, he was like just there having a great time. And I remember that because I'm like, you know what? You can kind of separate your doom and gloom about the markets and just have like a good life. I think that's a very useful lesson
to have. Well, but especially for him too. I mean, the reason he was celebrating is he was like, I mean, he was in a shooting gallery at that time. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that was like his 99, right?
I mean, but I love the guy. He's like, he's so thoughtful and he's on Twitter replying. He's one of the rare, like, I think he's one of the great, I think he's one of the greatest hedge fund managers in the world because he has the toughest gig in the world, shorting, which is the toughest thing. And he's out there, he's analyzing, he's methodical, he's very cerebral about his approach. And, you know, he's a super nice guy. So, you know, I'd be amazing to have him as a guest.
Yeah, we're certainly trying to line that up. And I would love to see, what he's doing, what he's thinking right now and where he's going and how he's playing this out. So when you now kind of the last thing I want to talk about is again, kind of looking at things from a broader view. Where do we go from here? Meaning I feel like we've talked about, I think we've covered this pretty well today in terms of, I think we're in a new reality, meaning I think you're just going to see increased central bank involvement and, you know, they keep setting fires that they have to be the firemen and put out. And, but where do we go from here as far as, you know, the China ish, you know, I don't think I've ever looked at the world and been more perplexed about what the next 5 to 7 years would look like. What does our friendly shrub see on the horizon?
I think 24 is going to feel like a party. And 25 is going to be a hangover.
Sure seems like that.
That's what I see. Yeah, that's what I feel.
What would get them to stop though? Right? Like what would get Yellen? I mean, obviously if Trump wins, he's going to be able to appoint somebody else at the Treasury. But also I don't see, you know, I don't think Trump's going to come in and really instill fiscal discipline, right? He can't.
Well, that's
the thing. We can't. Chase and I were laughing about this just the other day. We're like, hey, if you just normalize down to a 3% deficit, you'd be in recession right now, right? And you made that point.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. 3% is going to destroy the economy.
Which is wild to say, but it's true. So, yeah, where do
I think let me tell you the easy way to look at. The easy way to monitor things is to monitor the U.S. 10-year. If the U.S. 10-year stays around 4, 4.5, they can issue bonds. They can do whatever they want. I think the hint is going to be if they lose control of the long end of the curve.
Yep.
That's the one thing you should be looking at because that's what happened with the U.K. That's the hint we got last year. So if they lose the control of the 10-year, there's only two things they can do. They can do yield curve control, in which case the dollar is going to go down 20%, or they're going to have fiscal discipline. If they do, if they put fiscal discipline, just sell
everything.
All your equities. Yep. So sell everything and just put it all in bonds because the bonds are going to go from like, you know, 4.5 to maybe 3 because they're going to have to keep going. Or if they do YCC, then just stay long risk, put it all in commodities.
Like
if they do YC.
I just don't see fiscal discipline. I just
I'm the same. I just don't see them.
No.
Who's going to do it? Like between Biden and Trump? I mean, come on. you have like the Tamagotchi, the war, it's the war of the Tamagotchis. I mean, you have like Yellen on one side and, you know, Trump on the other. I mean, we've seen the precedent.
Well, and then the excesses are just so large. You just can't pull the plug on this. You look at the strains that are already there. I mean, you got more banks being rumored for, you know, all you hear is strong economy. I'm like, why am I hearing about bank troubles every bloody day? Right.
Because it's bullish. That's why you hear about bank troubles.
Right. Right.
Because, you know, it's in their interest for a bank to fail once in a while. Because if you see the headline for a bank failing, you're going to go and buy 10-year bonds to protect yourself against the GFC type crisis. But actually, you know, they just let one bank blow up every few months. So they just keep it going. Right. Right? Well, you have like 5,000 of them. Who cares?
And then we've said too, that you've got this perverse cycle going on where and we've seen this for a long time, but I think it's getting even more quick and more predictable, which is you've gotten the market to the point where, and again, I think it makes sense, where the biggest rallies happen in with the baddest news. And it,
Of course. As you know, SVB, you know, Signature Bank, all these things.
Yep. And the market has realized and fully realizes, in my opinion now, that the greatest source of capital is the central banks. And when they're pumping, we buy everything, right? So now they're front running pumping, right?
Yeah.
So, which we've said, you know, at some point the Fed is going to need that to stop. I think at some point the Fed is going to realize, like you said, I do think they've realized how financialized things are. I just don't think they're admitting it. Well, any final thoughts, sir? I hit most of my list. Quite honestly, I could probably sit here and do this for another hour, but I know we both got time constraints. Any closing thoughts?
Yeah, my closing thought, you know what it is? Just have fun in the markets, because I have a lot of friends who are depressed because things are crazy. Like, look, just sit back, have fun, be like Chainos, you know, just... You know, when the market shut, he becomes a different person. I think that's kind of my closing thought. You know, just disconnect from the markets in your personal life and just have fun.
And stay sane, right? Don't become one of the monkeys. Anyway, well, hey, I'm so glad we finally got to do this, and look forward to getting you on again. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
For people that want to follow you, so we got Agnostocks. At AGNOSTOXXX, three X's, right? That's your Twitter. And then where can they find the Substack?
Yep. It's www.shrubstack.com.
The shrubstack.com. And it's
called Reminiscences of a Shrub Operator. So if you go on Substack and it's like, you can search it on Substack, like Reminiscences of a Shrub Operator.
I love it, man. I love it.
We have fun there.
Yes, you do. And you bring humor into a very, to a very frustrating, which is one of the reasons I love getting the reads, just because you need a laugh, right? You got to laugh this stuff off. Absolutely. You can't take it home with you. All righty. Well, thanks for coming on again. We're going to have to do this again, and really appreciate the time. I hope you guys all enjoyed it as much as I did recording it. Got another great interview lined up for you next week, so you're not going to want to miss it. Until then, thank you for listening. And you're listening to Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember, investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.